From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Noted Renaissance man and baseball lover Chuck Norris once famously sang, "When you're in Texas, look behind you, because that's where the Rangers are going to be." But the current owner of the Rangers can't seem to put the team behind him. Ahead on Only a Game, a look at the Texas Rangers' twisted bankruptcy proceedings. Also, it's paddlers versus landowners on rivers across the country, and a neophyte surfer relishes his kook status. Also, meet NFL draftee Myron Roll, who is currently considering dual careers.
When I'm in between those lines, I put the hat on as being an aggressive, violent football player. When I'm off the field, that's when I think about being a cerebral thinking, potentially great neurosurgeon.
Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. D.C. may be united, but that hasn't helped them stay out of last place in Major League Soccer's Eastern Conference. Meanwhile, the Seattle Sounders have narrowly avoided sounding the depths of the West. Joining me now to talk about some of the teams actually in contention at the MLS All-Star break is Roger Bennett, co-author of the ESPN World Cup Companion and co-host of Off the Ball at ESPN.com. Welcome back to the program, Roger.
Bill, it's great to be back.
At the All-Star break, the Los Angeles Galaxy appears to be the class of MLS. They've won a league-best 12 games despite the absence of Landon Donovan during the World Cup. Do you anticipate that they will continue to flourish?
Yeah, there's been no bigger story in the MLS in the season thus far than the Galaxy. They're on a blistering pace to break the all-time points record. The wonderful Edson Buddle has been banging in the goals from all points. Landon Donovan has been an assist meister. What's even more remarkable, perhaps, is they continued their fine form, even with both of those blokes away for the World Cup, and seeing whether they can continue their first part of the season form. Now we're at the business end of the MLS year is going to be a great storyline to watch.
Well, as you say, Donovan is back in L.A. now, but there has been talk that he might return to Everton in the Premiership, where he played very well on loan for part of last season, and there's some other teams in the Premiership that have expressed interest as well. Can MLS hold on to Landon Donovan, and should they?
Poor Landon Donovan. He spent the first part of his career being damaged goods that nobody wanted. He's now everybody's darling and being pulled in 101 directions. Manchester City came through America and made a claim that they were going to sign him. What's probably good for the U.S. national team is that he leaves and continues his development in an elite league. But what's best for the MLS and its development is if he stays here. So it's a little bit of a footballing Sophie's choice.
The league's most intriguing recent acquisition certainly is Thierry Henry, late of Barcelona by way of Arsenal, who scored Thursday in his debut with the New York Red Bulls, albeit in a friendly. Does that team charge from second past the Columbus Crew and into first in the East?
Thierry Henry is a New York gentleman with New York charisma. He even took the PATH train out from New York City with the fans to the stadium for his debut. He is one of many designated players. The league now allows up to three per team, which is really them showing a decent amount of ambition about how they want to develop as a league. He was in his prime, which he's not now, a remarkable goal scorer. And unlike David Beckham, who arrived with a huge fanfare, I think Thierry Henry will provide the MLS with something it desperately needs right now, which is some highlights worthy of SportsCenter. And they really will be a team to watch.
Roger, you mentioned the change in MLS policy, which means teams can now sign as many as three designated players outside the salary cap. Do you suppose that that makes an immediate change in the league?
The MLS has always been about a slow build, fiscal responsibility. They allowed one designated player. One player really doesn't make a team. But they're now allowing two and the possibility of a third if a luxury tax is paid and redistributed to the other team. So players are starting to come through. Thierry Henry, Rafael Marquez is rumoured to be coming. And the question is, are these people going to come and just play like it's a retirement home where they can take the money, or are they going to be really motivated? The Daily Telegraph of England claim that the Major League Soccer League is turning into an elephant's graveyard.
On Wednesday night, the MLS All-Stars will host Manchester United, or at least some representation of same. Is this a good format for an MLS All-Star game?
It's as if the United States has, over the last month, just become one vast continental training ground for the elite teams of Europe, who are flooding over to play MLS teams as kind of boxing sparring partners as they warm up for their seasons. I mean, it's great for the MLS. It brings in a great crowd. The opponents are not particularly motivated. I think it will be a fun memory for lots of young kids in the stands, but the game itself may not be one to remember.
Roger, what about the effect of the World Cup? As predicted, it drew a great many television viewers here in the United States, even after the U.S. was out of it. But do those people now turn to Major League Soccer for entertainment?
The World Cup was a massive success for ESPN, who are claiming over 160 million Americans interacted with their media platforms. Really, it's the best of times for the MLS, and it's possibly the worst of times. It's a polarized league. There's new franchises in Seattle, Toronto, Philadelphia, where they've developed amazingly wonderful, vociferous sporting fan cultures. Seattle has averaged over 36,000 people a game. But then there's the old franchises like San Jose and New England, where the franchises feel a little stale, attendance is slumping. TV is really the massive problem. The cable rating is dire. Fox Soccer Channel are attracting about 53,000 viewers. But America really embraced the World Cup. The big question now is, will they embrace soccer? And I guess, will they embrace the MLS?
Roger Bennett is the co-author of the ESPN World Cup Companion. He is also the co-host of Off the Ball at ESPN.com. Roger, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Bill, thanks for having me on.
During the last few years, sport paddlers have been pushing the limit on the kind of water that only canoes, rafts, and kayaks can navigate, aggressive rapids, and even waterfalls. But paddlers are also waging fierce legal battles to try to open up more river routes that offer access to remote wilderness areas. Landowners are pushing back, arguing that the sport is stepping on their private property rights. North Country Public Radio's Brian Mann reports.
My journey into this story begins in the depths of Aussable Chasm, a flume of towering sandstone cliffs and whitewater that plunges through New York's Adirondack Mountains.
Some riffles ahead of me. I'm about to drop into a kind of class one rapids. Spectacularly beautiful here. I'm paddling a little bit to try to get myself off the rocks.
After freeing myself, I paddle a fairly easy stretch of the river. It's a tourist attraction run by a company that sells tickets to families who love to hike and paddle. But there's another class of paddlers, serious athletes who've been fighting for a decade to get a shot at some of the Aussable Chasm's fiercest rapids.
Coming over that first drop, it's you're entering this magical place. You're pitting your personal skills against that of the river and the environment, of the natural environment.
That's Andrew Ludke, a kayaker from Pennsylvania. This summer, he was one of the first paddlers ever to run this stretch of the Aussable River after a court decision opened the route. He was also one of the first to get injured.
I actually had trouble right near the beginning and ended up swimming out of the rapids below Horseshoe Falls. And as I came up against the cliff face, I pushed off the rock two or three times with my feet and swam aggressively to the other side of the river.
Ludke shrugs off the fact that he broke a bone in his hand, but he's furious at what he describes as harassment by the people who own the land on both sides of the river.
They were telling us that if we put a foot on dry rock, that we would be sighted. They were taking pictures of us, telling us they were radioing to the police that if we got out, that we would be cited for trespassing.
Ludke says the confusion put paddlers at risk, but John McDonald, president of the Aussable Chasm Company, thinks kayakers don't have any business running these rapids.
Personally, no, I don't, for one reason, because of the safety factor. They had a fella jump in the chasm, you know, from the bridge a few years ago, and a state police diver almost drowned trying to find his body.
McDonald concedes that on this particular river, the courts have spoken, giving paddlers the right to run the rapids a few months out of every year. But he fumes at the idea that his rights as a landowner have been chipped away. It turns out this kind of feud between paddlers and landowners is common right across the U.S.
They've told me to get out, given me dirty looks and threatened, and I haven't quite had a gun pointed at me, whereas other people I know have had guns pointed at them.
Eric Leeper is executive director of the National Organization for Rivers, a paddler advocacy group based in Colorado. Earlier this year, landowners in his state lobbied aggressively to defeat a bill that would have clarified the rights of paddlers to run most of that state's navigable rivers, even when they pass through private property.
Rancher after rancher got up there and said, "This ranch has been in my family for three or four generations, and now you're going to come take my property." And I do have sympathy because they have this longstanding misunderstanding that the river flowing through their ranch is private. Now, they know that the county road going through their ranch is not private, but they think the river is.
This is the pivot point of this debate, a tangled legal argument over what rivers are. Are they part and parcel of the private land that surrounds them, or are they travel corridors open to everyone for commerce and recreation? Phil Brown is an outdoor writer and paddler in New York who's written extensively about this conflict. He says there's actually a lot of legal precedent supporting the idea that rivers are a kind of traditional public highway.
This common law right dates back to Old England. So in a way, this represents our heritage. There was a time when rivers were used as travel, a sense that, you know, a private landowner doesn't own the rivers. Well, they may own the rivers, but the public has the right to travel on them.
But Terry Fankhauser, executive vice president of the Colorado Cattlemen's Association, says the fact that trappers and traders paddled a river decades or even centuries ago doesn't mean it should be open to modern sport paddlers.
The landowner has the ability to control access because they own the ground below, the banks of the river, and the air above the water.
This fight isn't just about whitewater. It's also about some of the country's most beautiful and remote flatwater rivers.
It's mid-afternoon, and after paddling for 2 days, we've come to a place in the middle of the wilderness where there are posted signs right across this wild Adirondack River, and these signs say that we're not allowed to go any farther.
A court case a few years ago seemed to confirm that at least here in New York, landowners can no longer restrict public access to navigable rivers. So the group I'm with decides to push on, ignoring the signs and ignoring the cable stretched across Shingle Shanty Brook. State courts and legislatures from Utah to Kansas have been wrestling with ways to clarify the rules on rivers like this one. But paddling advocates say confusion and conflicts are likely to shape their sport for a long time to come. For Only a Game, I'm Brian Mann in New York.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. What do you get for playing a video game called Red Dead Redemption for 50 consecutive hours? Not, as it turns out, actual redemption, red, dead, or in some other living color. But you do get a world record, at least according to those tireless folks at the Guinness World Book of Same. In a marathon of blips, zaps, and cyber carnage that began last Friday, six Dutch gamers tapped away at the Western-themed video game and smashed the previous record, which had been held by a relatively sensible Indian gentleman who quit after 40 hours and 20 minutes last September. For breaking the record, each of the six Dutch gamers also earned a 1,000 euro prize and no dates. None. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, an aspiring neurosurgeon accepts a paid internship to play in the National Football League. But first, you want to buy a ball club? Nolan Ryan does, and so do Mark Cuban and some other guys, and current Texas Rangers owner Tom Hicks certainly wants to sell. Joining me now to discuss one of the most chaotic financial circuses ever to feature a pro franchise is New York Times reporter Ken Belson. Welcome to Only a Game.
Hey, Bill.
Teams are bought and sold all the time, of course, but the amount of red ink in which current owner Tom Hicks is drowning makes the potential sale of the Texas Rangers unusual. How bad have things gotten for Mr. Hicks?
Quite bad. And actually, this is a long, drawn-out saga at this point because it started, frankly, back when the financial crisis hit in 08 and his underlying business went south. And finally, last March, he defaulted on $525 million in loans tied to the team and his sports business. He initially tried to sell a minority stake to raise cash to pay off the bankers. Minority stakes in baseball are very shaky things. You don't get the voting rights commensurate with your stake. And so since he had driven the business into the ground in the first place, I don't know who was willing to give him more money with less control. Eventually, he decided to sell a majority stake and started an auction process last summer. Long story short, a group led by Nolan Ryan, who is the current president of the team, and a lawyer named Chuck Greenberg, who owns a bunch of minor league teams, was chosen as the winner. All things sounded good, except that this group was not the highest bidder. And the bankers said, wait a second, we're owed a whole bunch of money. Why are you taking less than the biggest bid out there? And that has set off probably another 8-9 months of legal wrangling that has actually pushed the team into bankruptcy.
Well, as you say, a Houston businessman named Jim Crane is said to have offered the best price for the Rangers, but baseball commissioner Bud Selig wants the team to go to Nolan Ryan. Mark Cuban, that famously low-key owner of the Dallas Mavericks, is another potential buyer. Meanwhile, J.P. Morgan owns most of the debt that's been accumulated by Tom Hicks, so maybe the team really belongs to that company. What is the strategy at this point for sorting out the potential magnates and moguls?
Well, picture a gunfight where everybody's standing in a circle. That's sort of what's happening right now. The bankers have sued to get control of the team and to have it opened in another round of bidding. But now they're arguing about how to go about the bidding. The bankruptcy court judge normally would be able to read the Riot Act is now caught between everybody suing everybody else.
Well, the team, as I understand it, is supposed to go at auction on August 4th. The presiding judge, Michael Lynn, was very firm on that date because his niece is getting married on August 7th. Is this representative of the judge's behavior in the case?
Actually, the judge has been almost like Solomon here. He's got an awkward situation. Number one, he's got one of his constituents here is Major League Baseball, and they do carry a lot of weight. And then he's got a local client in the Texas Rangers, obviously a big part of the local community. And then he's got all these bankers, and the bankers want their fair shake. And, you know, in a normal bankruptcy, the judge would say, just re-auction it, and whoever offers the most money wins. But this isn't a normal bankruptcy because Major League Baseball has actually threatened to take over the club if they don't get their way here. So it's extremely complicated, and I think Judge Lynn has done his best to split the difference where he can. You know, going to the wedding is a whole other wrinkle, I think.
Well, how likely is it that the guys who wear Texas Rangers uniforms will find out on August 4th who will next be paying their salaries?
My sense is there's still a lot of room left to argue their case, the lenders to argue their case in court. You've had some very strange and often last-minute motions put in front of the judge. For example, Nolan Ryan, who works for the team, sued the team to try and get them to speed up the auction and to set rules and dates. Now, all of a sudden, Mr. Hicks, the owner, is saying, well, you know what, maybe there is somebody out there. So he's half siding with the lenders now who also want another auction. And then you got wild cards like Mark Cuban saying, wait a second, I'm willing to pay for that team, and I'll pay even a little more. And as we know, Mark Cuban's a variable quantity. He did try and bid for the Chicago Cubs and did not get a warm reception. So, you know, whether he's just simply throwing his hat in the ring because he can and he's doing it for his own amusement, or whether he's serious about it, it's still up to MLB to sort of steer who they think is an appropriate owner through the process as well.
Well, you bring up a very important point there, because historically, Major League Baseball has reserved to itself the right to decide who could join that exclusive club of Major League owners. If this team ends up going to the highest bidder rather than, say, to Nolan Ryan, who is the chosen candidate by Bud Selig, does it change the way Major League Baseball franchises change hands in the future?
Yes and no. I think there's been a gradual shift away from the old model, which is you find somebody who has a lot of money and potentially is willing to lose a lot of money on a club, particularly in the short term, and somebody who's not going to make a lot of waves. You know, the joke about the NFL owners is that it's as socialist a club as there is. You know, they like-minded people. There's the occasional squeaky wheel like Jerry Jones in Dallas, or Mark Cuban also in Dallas, and I guess now Tom Hicks also in Dallas. But for the most part, these clubs have become so complicated with cable networks involved, stadium deals, real estate deals around the stadiums, that you can't just have somebody who has a lot of money. You need somebody who is sophisticated enough to make the most of the team and help baseball grow as a business. And the commissioner's offices have had to come in and sort of semi-vet ownership groups on behalf of the owners and make sure that they have the wherewithal to do what they need to do to manage the club profitably.
Ken Belson is a sports business reporter for the New York Times, and in that capacity, he has been writing about the Texas Rangers. Ken, thank you very much for speaking with me.
My pleasure, Bill.
Nolan Ryan, he's a hero to us all. Nolan Ryan, he stands straight and he stands tall. He don't mess around, boys. He just throws a mean fastball.
Training camps for the NFL's 32 teams open next week. As Only a Game's Ron Schachter reports, Myron Rolle, a sixth rounder chosen by Tennessee, will compete for a position in the Titans' defensive secondary, even as he furthers his already impressive academic career.
Myron Rolle is a rookie with a resume. The 23-year-old safety and former Florida State University star is still shaking off the jet lag from spending the past year as a Rhodes Scholar at Oxford. He isn't the first Rhodes recipient to join the NFL. USC quarterback Pat Hayden did it in the 1970s. But Rolle's off-the-field accomplishments and future ambitions have drawn comparisons to basketball great and former U.S. Senator Bill Bradley, whom Rolle idolized growing up. Rolle starred and maintained a 4.1 average at the Hun School in Princeton, New Jersey, where in 2006 he was dubbed the nation's number one high school football prospect by ESPN. That was just down the road from the Ivy League University, where Bradley became a basketball legend 4 decades earlier. When he finally met Bradley 2 years ago, Rolle recalls, they became fast friends and mutual admirers.
The first thing he wanted to do was give me a hug and tell me how much I meant to him and how great it made him feel that I looked up to him and modeled my life pattern after his. And the first thing he did was just give me advice. You know, he sat me down and said, this is what Oxford's going to be like. This is what you should do. This is what I did wrong, and this is how you should approach it. That meant so much to me, obviously. I never thought I'd meet this man. I thought, you know, he was some mythical figure who just, you know, resided somewhere in the clouds.
Although Rolle is aiming to play in the NFL for the next decade, he plans to become a neurosurgeon afterwards and already has a leg up on the medical profession thanks to his newly minted Oxford Master's in Medical Anthropology. In graduating from FSU a year early and trading the hubbub of the college gridiron for the hum of the cars and bicycles in downtown Oxford and the medieval grandeur of its colleges, Rolle found himself on a different kind of all-star team with the 81 others from around the world in his Rhodes class.
This is Norman Manley, who was a Rhodes Scholar, Prime Minister of Jamaica. Bob Hawke, Rhodes Scholar, Prime Minister of Australia. Here's Bill Clinton, who was, of course, governor of Arkansas and then president of the United States.
Donald Markwell, the warden of Rhodes House, points out the portraits lining the building's main assembly hall. While Markwell doesn't expect Myron Roll's likeness to make it onto this wall anytime soon, he says that the scholar-athlete made a distinct impression while at Oxford.
He's a person of intense focus and determination who works extremely hard to balance the different things which he is doing. He's not going to be washed up and exhausted and over and done with when his football career is concluded. He's actually going to go on to another significant career way beyond that. So I think we'll be hearing from and about Myron for decades to come.
Many of Roll's Oxford classmates have followed his football progress. Friend and fellow Rhodes Scholar Aisha Saad, who's pursuing a degree in political philosophy, says that she's also received a continuing education in the workings of professional football.
Amongst the American Rhodes class especially, who do have a strong appreciation for the kind of time commitment and the demand and the fanfare that comes with the NFL in the U.S., it's definitely something that stands out, and I think it's something that everybody knows and talks about. I know around the time of the draft, we were sort of exchanging notes, and I was getting updates from more football-savvy folks than myself, and sort of keeping up with him.
From the moment Roll arrived in Oxford last fall, he combined his studies with daily early morning workouts to stay in shape for football. He returned to the U.S. so he could audition for the pros in January's Senior Bowl in Mobile, Alabama, and February's NFL Combine in Indianapolis. His MyronRoll.com website ticked down the months, days, hours, and seconds to the April draft. Roll's partner in prepping for the NFL was his older brother, McKinley, who followed him to Oxford.
Our whole family is a tight-knit family, and Myron being a baby, we want the best for him because he's going places and he's doing things that none of us in my immediate family have ever achieved.
His training regimen notwithstanding, Roll admits that he took a chance in going to school abroad.
One of those risks was that I was going to be out of sight, out of mind. Teams didn't know what I was going to be doing, how I was going to be training. So they weren't sure if I was going to be rusty or not, if I was going to lose the football language that's necessary, especially at safety, to be the true vocal leader that you need to be back there in the defensive backfield. That needs to be practiced over and over again in game situations, and that was obviously a concern.
Those fears didn't materialize, and the Titans chose Roll in the sixth round. Tennessee general manager Mike Reinfeldt says Roll would probably have been taken much higher in the draft had he played at FSU the past season. But the Titans scouts were sold on Roll's performance in the Senior Bowl.
He started a little slowly, but we thought he really picked up the pace and you know, got back to playing speed very quickly. The week there for him was a very good week, and he kind of calmed any concerns we might have had about being away from the game. And, you know, quite honestly, we were kind of intrigued by his intelligence, quite honestly, too. You know, he took time to go to Oxford, that he's, you know, he's a high achiever, he's goal-oriented. Those are qualities that it takes to succeed in the NFL.
Reinfeldt adds that Roll is going to have to master a new curriculum, and in a hurry.
It's like you need to have the playbook in your head, and I think the good thing with Myron, you know, he's got the intellect to be able to do that. Now, there comes another level because you also need to be able to play that at lightning speed. You know what I'm saying? You don't get 30 seconds to answer the question. It happens in a quarter of a second.
Even as Roll pursues his football career, he's kept his medical future in full view. Last year, he launched his own charitable foundation, which runs a wellness and leadership academy for children in Florida, and is raising $5 million to build a health clinic in the Bahamas, the native country of his parents. And Roll appreciates the irony that his road to becoming a neurosurgeon will run through years of banging heads with opposing receivers.
When I'm on the football field, I'm a football player. I don't assess the damages that could happen to my cerebellum when I'm trying to make a tackle on Brandon Jacobs from the New York Giants or someone like that. When I'm in between those lines, I put the hat on as being an aggressive, violent football player. When I'm off the field, that's when I think about being a cerebral thinking, potentially great neurosurgeon.
This fall, you may find Roll operating in the Titans' defensive secondary and on special teams. Tennessee opens its exhibition season at Seattle on August 14th. For Only a Game, I'm Ron Schachter.
You're listening to Only a Game. Clear evidence that at least some Only a Game listeners are choosy about television programs appeared on our Facebook page when Vin from Pleasant Lake, Michigan left this note regarding the LeBron James Hour. Vin wrote, "I'll be watching Burn Notice." Noel Fliss knew that Miami, Cleveland, and Chicago were the front runners in the LeBron-a-thon, but he shared with us another, more intriguing possibility. Think of the legacy he would leave if he signed with the Washington Generals and helped them finally defeat the Globetrotters, he wrote. In an email addressed to Charlie Pierce, Bob Frost, who hears the program on WCPN in Cleveland, presented a less frivolous take on LaFaire LeBron. "I'm very disappointed in you, Mr. Pierce, in that you didn't think loyalty was important on the part of LeBron. Cleveland gave him unfettered loyalty for 7 years, and he said, bleep you. I enjoy you on Only a Game usually, but your remarks in this instance fell very flat." Last week's program included some musing by me on the silliness of one of golf's rules. Dennis Couture of Raleigh, North Carolina, who listens to the podcast of the show, wrote to clarify that rule. "Yes, a penalty stroke is incurred when a ball moves after it is addressed," he wrote, "but the player has not addressed the ball until the club has been sold, S-O-L-E-D, behind the ball. So, if the player soles the club, pressing down on the grass behind the ball, which then moves, it is impossible to allocate blame between the player and the wind for the ball having moved, and the player takes the fall. And I rest my case, and thank you, Dennis, for reminding me why I sold, S-O-L-D, my clubs years ago." Jenny Beeman, who listens to the program on WFCR, WNNZ, and WAMC, probably enjoys Only a Game sometimes, but she emailed on July 11th with a complaint. "The WNBA All-Star Game was today," she wrote. "How could you not at least mention it?" Whether you think we failed to note something significant or said more than we should about LeBron, oops, mentioned him again, let us know by contacting us through the website onlyagame.org. You can leave a message on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can also join our Facebook friends at facebook.com/onlyagameradio and follow us on Twitter, username onlyagameradio. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm with 3,000 professionals worldwide. Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. And Harvard University, whose Harvard Extension School offers online and on-campus courses to students around the world. Extension.harvard.edu. This is NPR.
To the organizers of a duck race designed to raise money for charity, the use of 17,000 plastic ducks must have seemed like a good idea at the time. And then the actual event transpired in Fort Wayne, Indiana last weekend, and oops, in its wake, about 2,000 of the little critters went missing. Heroic efforts by people monitoring the St. Joseph River have since resulted in the recapture of about 1,000 of the Airsats quackers, some of which were retrieved as far away as Ohio. But that means about 1,000 of them are still, to paraphrase the Creedence Clearwater Revival, rolling on the river, or perhaps bobbing on it, unless by now they've all been eaten by plastic alligators. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, Surf City, here we come. Or rather, Ciudad de Olas, vamos a llegar, or something like that, since author Pete Heller mostly surfed in Mexico. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce from the studios of Milwaukee Public Radio for discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
You probably surfed down there with Gigetta.
I don't know. It wasn't in the book, but Marquise Pouncey, the Steelers' offensive lineman who formerly plied his trade at Florida, has an attorney now, and through that attorney, he has denied that he received $100,000 from an agent before last season's Sugar Bowl. Have you kept track of how many investigations of former or current Southeastern Conference football players we've got going now?
Well, the joke used to be that America had three professional football conferences, the AFL, the NFL, and the SEC. That is starting to be apparently ring a little bit less funny than the NCAA. Once again, I mean, we go through this every couple of years. We have these spasms of outrages. People want the product more than they want the NCAA's rule book.
Speaking of outrage, Nick Saban, the football coach at Alabama this week, referred to guys who pay players who are still in college as, quote, pimps. So, accurate characterization?
Well, if anyone should know it, he would know it. I mean, this is a guy who's pimped himself all over the Southeast from college to professional football his entire career.
USC, which is not in the Southeastern Conference, has fired
it
the athletic
spirit,
director.
It is in spirit, however.
In spirit, I think. I'm going to get to that. They fired their athletic director, Mike Garrett, and they returned Reggie Bush's Heisman Trophy, although Bush has not returned the original, as far as I know. Is this evidence that institutional control has been reestablished at USC, or did they just need more room in the trophy case?
It's interesting. I wonder if they also gave back Mike Garrett's Heisman Trophy because he was the athletic director they fired. You know, Reggie Bush should hang on to his Heisman Trophy. He should keep it on his mantelpiece. He earned it. He won it. And he owes nothing to the National Collegiate Athletic Association.
One plan under consideration as a result of these stories of agents paying players who are still in college would have the NCAA changing the rules and allowing college players to have agents. What do you think of that idea?
I think it's a terrific idea. I also think it's opening the floodgates, but I've been one who's been, you know, banging his head against the floodgates trying to get them to open for 20 years now. So all in all, I think it's a promising notion.
Charlie, apparently you can count Brett Favre's agent among those who were tired of the veteran quarterback's ongoing will-he-play-or-not saga. Buss Cook called his client a blankety-blank drama queen this week. I wonder if this means Mr. Favre will be looking for a new agent.
That's unbelievable. You will never hear an agent say that about a client, let alone a prominent one. And I wonder what's more insulting, the blankety-blank part or the drama queen part?
The man who was referred to as the Major, at least when he was managing the Yankees, died on Wednesday. Ralph Houk was 90 years old. He led New York to championships twice during the early 60s. He was somewhat less successful with the Red Sox and the Tigers, but I'm sure you will not be surprised to learn that he is being very fondly remembered this week.
When I was first writing sports at the Boston Herald, I had to go on an end-of-the-season dragging it out road trip with the Red Sox to, I believe it was Kansas City and Detroit. And he was very kind to me and very nice and very much the old baseball dude I expected to meet. Also, one of the great replies of all time. Somebody asked him if he was nervous about managing in the World Series. And Ralph Houk, who'd been through World War II, said, "Why? Is somebody going to shoot me?"
The New Jersey Devils offered talented free agent forward Ilya Kovalchuk a 17-year, $102 million contract. But the National Hockey League quickly rejected the deal, and they haven't said why. You don't suppose it's because it has something to do with circumventing the salary cap, do you?
It's because the contract is idiotic. And yes, it does circumvent the salary cap. But consider this. Some kid out there is a junior in high school, Bill. And he's getting great grades, and he really has a gift with numbers, and he's going to go to business school, and he's going to get a degree in accounting, and he's going to be such a talented guy that gets hired, snapped up immediately from a major accounting firm, one of the clients of which is the New Jersey Devils.
Mm-hmm.
That kid will have to cut a check to Ilya Kovalchuk.
Yeah, I mean, I don't see any reason why a good hockey player shouldn't still be in peak form at the age of 44, 45.
Well, you know, I think personally that if the Mayans are right, I think they may only be on the hook for a couple years. So life is good.
There's a new trend at Major League ballparks lacking fans. It's the all-you-can-eat section, which has apparently caught on at Camden Yards in Baltimore, which certainly lacks fans, and at 18 other Major League ballparks as well. Here's the deal. You pay $40 for your ticket, and you sit in a special section, and you get all-you-can-eat, bucket loads of food. Good idea?
If it catches on and they do it for a couple of years, you're not going to have to sell as many tickets to fill the section. It's brilliant.
Because the seats will have to be bigger.
Because people will be gigantic. Exactly.
The outrage of all the people who are trying to combat obesity at this.
I just don't want you have to set up your stadium so that the all-you-can-eat section is not directly above the projectile vomiting section.
Mm-hmm.
Because
mm-hmm.
Nobody will want to sit there.
Keep those separate, definitely.
Take me out to the ball game, buy me some peanuts and atherosclerosis.
And then buy me some more.
Buy me some peanuts and peanuts and peanuts and peanuts and peanuts. In the all-you-can-eat section, that song never ends.
In our ongoing celebration of ballpark promotions that aren't fattening, I invite you to salute the single-A Lake County captains of Eastlake, Ohio. Tomorrow, they will hand out leg lamp baubles as part of their Christmas in July celebration. And what fan won't be thrilled to go home with a major award?
It's terrible because, you know, it's obviously drawing from the Christmas Story, the famous Gene Shepard movie that gets run every Christmas. I think they should have a competition for people who get their tongue stuck to metal poles in the middle of July. I think that would be great.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. He joins me each week at this time as well on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
All you can eat.
If you'd like to leave a comment about something you heard on Only a Game, or less likely challenge my standing as the world's foremost expert on the history of the Internet and the poetry of Sir Walter Scott, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. How does one make a life? That's a question Peter Heller asks early in his new book, Kook, subtitled What Surfing Taught Me About Love, Life, and Catching the Perfect Wave. Heller himself finds that making a life, and perhaps not coincidentally making a book, involves long and often rewarding trips to find waves and people who can help him learn to ride them. Peter Heller joins me now from the studios of KGNU in Boulder, Colorado. Welcome to Only a Game.
It's great to be here. Thanks.
Peter, it would be no exaggeration to say that when you decided you wanted not just to learn to surf, but to become a surfer, you were a couple of decades older than most beginners, right?
Yeah, I was 47, and in Huntington Beach, where I first started, they said, you know, hey, if you're over 30, you're always going to be riding a big, heavy longboard because it's the most stable. And pretty much, you know, I got a lot of pitying looks.
At least part of what drove you to learn to surf, apparently, was the conviction that it would make you a better person. Where did that notion come from?
Well, I'd always loved the ocean, and I had just done a really exhausting thing. I'd been on an expedition to Tibet, which was very rigorous, and I'd written a book about it, and I was kind of exhausted. And I thought, you know, I've done a big thing. Now, could I do a lot of little things for a while, or, you know, what should I do? And my romantic life wasn't really shaping up that great because I was a commitment phobe. And it just occurred to me, you know, I was just drawn to water. Maybe the way, you know, Ishmael and Moby Dick describes the way people are drawn to the sea. It just felt like a place that maybe I could find some meaning. And the sea seems forgiving, like it'll accept you however you show up.
Although Ishmael had some problems once he got out there with Ahab.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, he did.
Well, once you began sitting on a surfboard and waiting for waves, were you surprised to learn that surfing hadn't made everybody else out there good people?
That was interesting. I mean, you know, my friend and I, he was a corporate lawyer that was having a tough year, and it started because he had a vacation coming up, and he asked me if I'd come and learn to surf with him. He'd been transferred to Huntington Beach. So we got some boards, and we ran right out to the pier, into the water right at the pier at Huntington Beach, which is really not what you're supposed to do when you're a kook or a rank beginner. Mm-hmm. That's where, you know, the experts surf. It's sort of ground zero for surfing on the mainland United States. And a kook is not a neutral term. It carries a slug of derision, and it really means the guy that paddles up to the lineup of expert surfers and starts talking to them like it's a cocktail party and ignores, you know, all the finely tuned protocols of surf and drops in on other surfers and, you know, collides with them. And the first surfer I met told me that I was a bleeping kook and I should get the bleep out of the water before he bleeped me up. And it hurt my feelings. But the odd thing, Bill, is that, you know, after that one day and then the next of sort of just getting thumped, I found that there was nothing else that I'd rather do. All I wanted to do was go back into the surf and try and get a couple of seconds standing up on the board. It was weird.
Well, I can understand why you wanted to learn to surf, but I don't understand why you decided that you had to try to become a really good surfer in just a matter of months. Why the competitive aspect to this adventure?
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of like the Plimpton thing, you know, could I be a professional quarterback in a year? That kind of thing had always intrigued me, you know, the full immersion, the steep learning curve. I always really loved that. I did an article for Men's Journal about learning to, you know, fly a plane in 20 days, and it was, you know, exciting. And I kind of liked the drink from the fire hose approach, but turns out that surfing is really, I mean, it's a life path, and people start when they're little kids, and, you know, they surf their whole lives. And I did end up going to a school where, you know, the oldest surfer was 89-year-old woman who was, you know, totally stoked. But it takes dedication. And also this idea, it was sort of like I needed a next book, and it was sort of like it was a gimmick, you know, could I go from kook to riding a big, fast, hollow wave in 6 months? And, you know, boy, wouldn't that make a good book. But, you know, once I got on the path of trying to learn to surf, I became humbled really quickly, and I learned that, you know, you can't just do that. And also, I invited the woman I was dating to come with me at the time on this long trip, and I found out that there were other more important things than maybe learning to surf that quickly, like learning how to love another person and learning about the oceans, which are in deep trouble, I came to find out.
A number of different people taught you things about surfing, practical stuff, of course, but also ways to think about what you were trying to do. Looking back, do you find yourself remembering a favorite teacher among all of them?
Yeah, I sort of had two favorites. One was the Saint of Seal Beach. He was a reformed Hell's Angel who was disabled, and he'd hurt himself falling off a telephone pole as a lineman, and he'd fused all the bones in his lower right leg, and he taught himself to surf again. He'd been a passionate surfer, and he figured, you know, if he could teach himself to surf, he could probably teach anyone. And it turns out he's like the best surf instructor in the country. Like, investment bankers will fly from Chicago to take a lesson with this guy, and, you know, stars from Hollywood. So he was an extraordinary person, and he made surfing really fun. And then the second guy was a guy in Mexico who was my age. He was a master champion in Mexico, and it was like the Karate Kid with him, following him around, because he didn't really believe in teaching. So he would just, you know, you'd paddle up to him and say, Leon, what's my lesson for the day? And he'd say, watch the peaks. That's what you should do today. Watch the peaks. And then he'd paddle off, and I'd be like, all right. I didn't really know what he meant, but I appreciated that approach also.
You know, it struck me reading this book that there's an interesting tension operating throughout it. Sometimes you seem to be saying surfing really is the point of all your journeying, and that's sufficient. And then at other times you seem to be saying that learning to love somebody else well and fully, in this case, Kim, your wife, was the real purpose of the trip. Was it one or the other?
Listen, I'm a flawed individual, you know, at base. And basically, I'm a kook and I'm about everything that I do, you know. And I realized, you know, that inviting Kim seemed like a great idea. It seemed like a good idea to really try and get to know this person that I loved. But I didn't really trust that, you know. Like, when I said I loved someone before, it always meant that in the near future that they'd be really mad at me, you know. So I invited Kim with the intention of, you know, really trying to get to know this person. And I don't know. I mean, still at times, you know, there's nothing I'd rather do than just take off and go surfing. I just was in Mexico for 3 weeks surfing. I just love it. On the other hand, you know, I really love learning to be patient, learning to be accepting, and, you know, having some commitment in my life. We got married on the trip, and it's been wonderful.
So even though you're speaking to me from Colorado, where you make your home, you're not living in a constant state of torture because, hey, there's no ocean there.
Yeah. I paddled his surfboard around the lake in front of our house, and it's pathetic, kind of. You know, people are always like, what are you doing? You know, are there waves here? You know, I had a kid ask me that. I'm like, no.
Well, landlocked as you are now, do you find yourself thinking back on a particular great ride? And if so, where and when did it occur? Because it's impossible to talk about somebody who writes a book about surfing without saying, did you find the perfect wave?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. There were two rides, and one I'm not going to talk about because it sort of comes at the end of the book. But there was one in Baja at a place called Scorpion Bay, which people had said, you know, you've got to go to this place. It's like a 10, you know, you're surfing all these waves. You don't realize how crappy they are until you go to Scorpion Bay and see a real perfect wave. So we took the 35-mile teeth-jarring washboard road. We let a lot of air out of the tires. We went 20 miles an hour, and still, you know, we arrived just rattled. And there was this beautifully curving bay, a little fishing village, and a point that had one, two, three smaller points made up this one jutting sort of peninsula. And each one had a long wave. And there I caught my first ride, and it was like, I know because I timed another surfer from where I had caught it. It was a 40-second ride, and that might not sound like a long time, but for a beginner surfer, it's like, you know, it's like endless. It was like heaven, and the wave was just broke evenly. It was sort of like the tear on a FedEx pack. That's how perfectly straight across. And I kind of, you know, I fell off my board at the end of that, and I just thought, you know, if a shark comes and takes me right now, that would be fine. I could die right now. It was so beautiful.
Peter Heller is the author of Kook, What Surfing Taught Me About Love, Life, and Catching the Perfect Wave. The book is published by Free Press, and the author joined me from KGNU in Boulder, Colorado. Peter, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Tribou. Our technical director is John Ferrati. We had help this week from Evan Perkins at KGNU in Boulder and John Strelecki at Milwaukee Public Radio. Special thanks to Karen Pelland. Jack Flagler is our intern. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view photo galleries, subscribe to the Only a Game podcast, listen to archived chosen stories, or learn more about our weekly music selections, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game Radio. Our final word comes from one of Peter Heller's surfing partners. It is amazing how those right whales can drop into the point break on those short boards in baggies and sing about it. Gnarly! I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from WBUR Boston. LendingTree, providing up to 4 loan offers from a network of lenders. Learn more at LendingTree.com or 800-555-TREE. The Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day at WallaceFoundation.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at MacFound.org. This is NPR.